Yes.
Are we ready?
Whoops. Okay. Okay, are we there?
Yes, you're there. We can hear you.
I've got something on my page here. Okay. Are we okay?
We don't see your page.
You don't see? You see me?
I see you.
Okay, that's all. Yeah. I mean, what I meant is somebody had put something on my screen that, and I clicked okay on it and all that, but it didn't disappear. So I got rid of that. So good morning, everybody. This is Luther Wood, alcoholic. And I'm so happy to be here with you this morning. And I thank you so much, Yvonne, for asking me to do this. You know, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alan. You know, these are some of the most places for us to be. You know, we have somewhere that we can be. And I use my last name, and I'll tell you why. And Dr. Bob and the good old timers, Dr. Bob says that the AA who hides his identity from his fellow AAs by using only a given name violates the tradition just as much as the AA who permits his name to appear in the press in connection with matters pertaining to AA. So, and that's not up for argument or whatever this morning, it's just what I do, okay? Because how many times have I gone to see somebody in the hospital or whatever and I didn't know their last name? You know, is Joe here? You know, and they look at you like, hello, Joe who? So anyhow, I am very, very happy to be here with you this morning. And we have a lot of material to cover. Ordinarily, I have 3 days to do what I'm attempting to do today. So we're going to skip over a lot of things. And I do want some time at the very end to let you ask questions or whatever, you know, because I do say some things from time to time that stimulate people. And they they want to know, why did you do that? Or how did you do that? Or whatever. And you know what? I am so happy to reveal myself to you, completely let you know who I am. And if in the interest that it will help you, that is my prayer every single morning of my life before I get out of bed. Dear God, please let me be of service to you and to our people. You know, and I have to warn you right now, I'm a big crybaby. Alcoholics Anonymous broke me open completely. And I started to cry the very first moment I sat around that table with those people, you know, and it's opened up my heart. It's enabled me to see and to hear, so I can see you and I can hear you, just like I could hear them that morning when they brought me home with them, you know. So I want to allow for some questions and answers and all of that, you know, and I'm going to move right along as quickly as I can. So I hope you have a good time with me this morning. I hope I can be of service to you and help you in your search for whatever you're looking for. You know, I assure you that it's in the seeking. You know, here's something that I believe down deep in my soul someplace. The seeker is one who has already been touched by God in such a way that nothing less will ever do, okay? We're not going to accept anything less. That's who we are. And so if you will stay steadfast and stay in here for the long run, I assure you that your dream will come true for you here. Because it's available to all who seek. I do not believe that one person can be excluded from this precious gift that we're given from him who made us, you know. So if one of us is, as Chuck Chamberlain used to say, who was an icon in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, if one of us isn't if one of us is excluded, we're all excluded, you know, because, and I believe that as well, too, because I don't know any penurious little God that would give me something and not give it to you, okay? I don't want to know any God like that either. You know, that's the God that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with. I had crossed so many lines in my life that I thought I would never be forgiven. So God was armed for me and ready for me when I got here. And I was going to have a life of eternal punishment and all of that. You know, that's not what's happened to me. I have been given the keys to the kingdom, for crying out loud. And it's available to you as well, I assure you. So, you know, I'm going to launch into, I never planned to be an alcoholic. That was not what's on my mind when I was 16 years old, a senior in high school. And my teacher looked out over the class and said, one of the 25 of you in here one day will go to the nut house as the direct result of drinking. And I remember saying to myself, it won't be me. And I went to the nut house four times. Well, actually five times, but I just came in the front door and went out the back one time. So I really can't count that one too much, you know. Anyway, in fact, the last time I was in the nut house, I escaped into the nut house because I'd been out there for some time. And my father, a man that I call my father, okay, he was not my father, but he was the only man that ever treated me like he was my father. And he was Jewish, and my mother was a shiksa. And one morning at 3:30, I came to, I was living at home still, I was about 32. And, those poor people, they had so many suitcase drills with me, in and out, in and out, in and out. And I woke up at 3:30 or came to at 3:30 in the morning. And I had these voices going on in my head, and they were talking about keys. And I'm thinking, what do keys do? And I thought, well, wait a minute. Keys reveal things, keys open things, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, I know what I need to know. What I need to know is in the book of Revelations. So I got out my grandfather's Masonic Bible, and I went back in my room with it and shut the door. I didn't want them to think or to know that I was in there reading the book of Revelations. So I didn't even turn the light on. And I was in the closet striking matches, reading Revelations, when my mother opened the door and screamed for my father to come and get me out of there before I burned the house down, you know. And he did. He came in. You got to understand something. My father is a gentleman. Okay. My father was a chemist. My father was a graduate of Harvard and MIT. And his idea of fun was sitting up in bed about 7:30 at night working on a new formula, you know. And he is what I would call a gentleman. And he grabbed a hold of me and yanked me out of there with all the smoke and everything. All the clothes were hanging over me, and I'm lighting all these matches. And anyway, we got into it, and I said, well, why don't you just hit me, you know, which he did. And then I saw the look on his face. I drove my family nuts, you know. When I made amends with my sister has the bluest eyes on the planet. She was sitting there with tears coming down her face, and she called me by my family name. She said, Bo, I have loved you all my life. I wanted to marry somebody like you. I wanted to come and see you toward the end of your drinking, but I was afraid to because I thought I might find you dead. You know, so that's the way I affected all kinds of people, you know, even the last person on the planet that loved me as if I were her own blood. I went to her house on a Friday night, and when she and her husband went to bed, I drank all the booze in their house. And the next morning, they didn't say a word about it. They had already gone to bed, you know. But when we got up, Margaret fixed me a wonderful breakfast and everything. Then she pulled her purse out and gave me a $20 bill. And she said, Bo, honey, don't ever come back to my house again. That was like the last person saying no to selfish, self-centered little Luther Wood, you know. So my father, the look on his face was like, oh, my God, you know. And then he looked at me and he said, son, you have to go. You have to leave this morning. We can't do this anymore. We can't watch this anymore. It's driving us crazy, you know. It's so hurtful, we can't do it, you know. So you have to leave, and you have to leave this morning, you know. And I got a few things together, and about 5 or 5:30 in the morning, I left. And I sort of remember, I've been drinking for a long time, like 3 weeks or so. And I sort of remember a yellow cab door. And then, mind you, I was in Seal Beach, California. The next thing I remembered was I came to in jail in San Francisco with a crumpled up airline ticket in my pocket on my way to Oyama, British Columbia to see a casual acquaintance, right? So obviously I'd been kicked off the plane in San Francisco, and that judge on Monday morning when I was getting out of jail let me go on my own recognizance because I'd never been arrested in San Francisco before. And the reason I'd never been arrested in San Francisco before is because I'd never been to San Francisco before. My story's in the book. It says he was always more or less insanely drunk. That was me, you know. I didn't intend to be that way, like I said, at 16 years old, but the first drink I ever had turned me into something. You know, it's that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality. That happens to us. So anyway, and then I escaped into the nut house after I got out on hitchhiked and was hitchhiking down to a guy picked me up in a blue Volkswagen, and he I hadn't said a word to him. We traveled all through the night down into the next morning. And then I said, well, that's kind of weird, isn't it? I hadn't said a word to him up to that point. And he said, what's kind of weird? And I said, well, it's odd that they would play that song three times in a row. I don't know why. I like the song, but why would they play it three times in a row? And he said, I don't have a radio in this car. You have to get out here. So he dropped me off underneath a sign that said Camarillo State Hospital on Highway 101, you know. And I walked there because they're very unfriendly in that area. It said, no hitchhiking, blah, 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 blah. So I had to walk all the way from one. It's about 6 miles or so, I think. I don't know exactly, but I went across the tomato fields and ate tomatoes and so on and so forth and got into the nut house. And I didn't mind living in the nut house, I want you to know, because I could shower as often as I wanted to. They turned the lights. I left the lights on at night, you know. They locked the doors at night so they couldn't get in, you know. And the only problem there is they medicated me so heavily, 22 tablets of some sort, three times a day, you know. And that's what they like to do with us. They like to experiment with us. And every nut house that I was in, they did something very similarly. And luckily enough, I got out of there, you know. I made it back to where Redondo Beach, and I finally got me enough money together. I could get a little apartment and so on and so forth. And I remember very clearly that, by the way, when I was in the nut house, they diagnosed me there. And they diagnosed me paranoid schizophrenic. They were deliriously happy about that. I was in another way because it explained all the voices that I'd been experiencing most of my life, you know. So anyway, I'm there in Redondo Beach, and I remember this very, very well. This was August the 15th in 1972. I had been drinking for 3 weeks again. I didn't know anything at all about Alcoholics Anonymous or you or whatever. I didn't know there was any help for people like me anywhere, okay? I'd already been through all the doors, the ministers, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the very well-meaning people, all those wonderful people. And I had, you know, there I was drinking for 3 weeks, standing on my porch. I looked across the courtyard and I saw them bringing a body down the staircase across me with a red blanket on it. And I remember I've been drinking for 3 weeks, but I had this moment of clarity where I thought, this is what's going to happen to me. That's the very best that I can hope for, you know. It was kind of like a curtain fell, and I was coming in and out of a little blackout, by the way, you know. So I scratched around for my bottle. People had been coming in my house. They'd stolen everything that wasn't nailed down on the ground floor, and someone had taken my bottle away. Probably someone trying to help me, you know. And so I thought, oh my God, I have to get another bottle of wine. So I started drinking Tokay wine, and I ended drinking Tokay wine. I came full circle. And So, and by the way, in that 3 weeks of drinking, we wore bell-bottom trousers in those days. They were so tight, you would break your neck if you tried to get in and out of them, you know. And so I was all cut up in black and blue. I quit showering. I mean, forget that. I couldn't get in and out of the pants, number one. And then in that shower tub enclosure, I was falling around in there. So I'm all black and blue and cut up. And it was just ridiculous. And I had this big afro, you know, and I love that afro. I could me and Angela Davis, you know, I could get that thing all fluffed up. It would take about 5 hand towels to get it really nice and dry, and then it fluttered like a bird's belly. You know, I just friggin' loved it. That's how I came to the program. I could, let's see if I could possibly bring you up a picture of that. I do have a picture of me. With that afro. Can you see me there?
Yes.
You see that? That's how I looked when I got here. And
sideburns.
Yeah. So, oh my God, I hope I got rid of that, you know, in the screen share. Yeah, I did. Okay. Anyway, I was coming in and out of a blackout, and I was on my way to a thrifty drugstore to steal another bottle of wine, okay, which was a nightmare because the kids in the neighborhood would rake sticks across the fence trying to scare me, you know, and dogs chasing me up and down the street, and it was just ridiculous trying to get just 3 bucks, you know, to a thrifty drugstore. And so I got it, and it always amazes me that I didn't get arrested for shoplifting, because honest to God, I looked like I was going to shoplift, okay? I was dirty, I didn't smell good, and cut up. So I got into God has been able to, or has given me the ability to really see me and to see me. When I tell you these stories, I see it. I see the whole story again. So it's been a tremendous gift. And like I said earlier, and just with the hope that somebody out there will identify and somebody will say, oh my God, there's hope. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, trust me, I had no hope. None. None. I had given up long, long ago. So anyway, I went into Thrifty's and I stole my bottle of wine. And I got out, and the next thing I remember, I was in a phone booth. And I was talking to a doctor in Long Beach, and he said, I can't help you. And then I went in the blackout and came out the other side. I have no idea how I got a hold of Alcoholics Anonymous. But these people said, you stay right where you are and we'll be down to get you. And that was Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I must have told them where I lived, because I'm sitting down there. And I lived on the corner of my sofa. And around me in the coffee table there, it was all trashed, cigarette butts, Brew 102 plant. I don't even know if they make that. It was the greenest beer on the planet, you know. And I'd put out cigarette butts in it and stuff and wake up in the, or come to, I should say, in the morning and drink that friggin' beer with cigarettes in it. Oh, come on. We just who we become, you know. And anyway. These three guys walked right into to my house. And by the way, one of the three guys that came to get me died the other day. So I don't have anybody that came to get me anymore. They're all gone. And I'm 82 years old, by the way. So, you know, and I realize I'm on the other side of my life as well. And so, you know, George Bernard Shaw says something very curious. He said, at the end of his life, when he's thrown up on that scrap heap of life, he wants to be all used up. And God, last week I was complaining. My phone rings all the time. I'm speaking too much. I'm going on and on and on and on. And then I heard this voice in my ear saying, Luther, you said you wanted to be all used up, dear. That's what's going on. So it isn't funny to anybody else, but it's funny to me. So be careful what you pray for, folks. You might get it. And so anyway, they walked in there, and this one guy that just died last week walked straight up to me and said, "We've been right where you are." And that made me so mad I couldn't see straight. I said, "You have never been where I am, you know?" And then there was a great big guy. We called him Big Bob. I mean, he was big. He was like Shaquille O'Neal, right? He says to me, "What are all those little scraps of paper on that coffee table there?" And I had hundreds of little pieces of paper with really important stuff on it. And I said, "For your information, these scraps of paper you're referring to are formulas that Albert Einstein wanted to release to the universe, but he died before he was able to, and I'm the channel he's writing them through. That's what these little scraps of paper are. And by the way, he's my grandfather," you know, which he is not. But it would not be odd that I would tell you that, because I loved Albert Einstein. I identified whatever reasons with Albert Einstein, you know. Later on, when they took me home with him, I remember Dan saying to Dottie, when they took me home, that was his wife, "Is it okay if we put up Albert Einstein's grandkid for a couple of days?" You know, I was never going to see these people again. I didn't know who they were, you know. And so that very guy, Dan McCafferty, my first sponsor, said, "Are you going to go with us?" You know what? I didn't know who us was, and I didn't know where we were going. And here's the finger of God. I said, "Yes, I'm going to go with you." And I got up, and here's the finger of God again. I got up. I went in the kitchen and poured myself a glass of wine, but I didn't drink it right then. And later on, a few days later, he said to me, "If you had drunk that wine right then and there, we would have left you." See? And I can't afford to be left out there. I don't know how to do this without you. You showed me how, for your own example, how to do this. You gave me this gift, you know? Because Clint Hodges, when I worked with him, said, "God," he said, "Luther, God will love you through me, and he will love me through you." Because, see, I found out one of the greatest secrets of all time, and I hope to talk about it today, of where and the location of God himself is. You know, I have found that it's in the people. It's in you, and it's in me, and it transfers back and forth between the two of us and everybody else on the planet, whether you know it or not. You know, if you don't know it, keep seeking. Stay here. Stay with us. Stay in for the long run, because the reward is overwhelming. So anyway, I went upstairs to get one of my disguises, and I was in the disguise. It's so obvious to me how I got arrested all the time today. You know, I'd stand around the street corner in Belmont Shore at 11:30 at night, right? Wearing a black fedora, a black overcoat, black turtleneck sweater, black slacks and black boots, and black sunglasses that you could not possibly see through at 11:30 at night, right? I stuck out like a sore thumb. I think they should print this on the label of alcohol. "Caution, drinking this beverage may make you think you're invisible." You know, anyway, I came down the stairs with my lavender tank top, yellow Bermudas, and hexagonal-shaped sunglasses. God forbid I should be normal, you know, that you couldn't possibly see through and out the door. I went with these people into the night. And when I came to the next morning, I didn't know where, you know, they didn't say anything about me being dirty or cut up or smelly or whatever. They came and got me. They took me to a really decent, clean home. I came to the next morning, and I had someone else's pajamas on. It was in a strange bedroom. And the only thing of it is I just didn't know where it was. That had been the story of my life many times. You know, I wanted my first sponsor's wife to be my sponsor in the beginning, because she said she got tired of saying waking up and saying, "Who are you and where are we?" You know, so but she said, "Honey, I can't do that. Men work with men. Women work with women." So anyway, I heard voices, and I got up and I followed them out to the kitchen table. And there they were. There were all these people sitting around, about six of them in the morning, eating breakfast, having protein drinks. They gave me one. I threw it up instantly. Milk and me don't get along when I'm sobering up. So anyway, I'm sitting on the edge of my chair and I'm starting to shake. I've been drinking for 3 weeks and I'm shaking. I had the leaps by now, you know, and I didn't know exactly where I was. I was hoping they would start passing the bottle around, and you know, and that's not what they were doing. And I'm sitting there on the corner of my chair, and one of them says to me, "You know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk." I said, "What?" Because I didn't know that. I always thought I shouldn't have the last one. If I didn't have the last one, I wouldn't have wound up in the hospital, back in the nut house, a black eye, in jail, or whatever. And he said, no. If you're anything like us, it's the first one that sets up something in us that it does not in other people. That phenomenon of craving takes over. And we can no longer predict with any accuracy whether we're going to wind up or down. We don't know what's going to happen from that moment on. And it goes click, you know. And so I'm sitting there and I'm listening to them talk. And as time would go on here, just a few minutes later, my friend Shirley, I had no hope at all when I got here, okay? My friend Shirley was sitting there, and she just nonchalantly says, "Yeah, one drink is too many, a thousand's not enough." And my head blew up. And I started to cry, and I had not cried for years. You couldn't make me cry. And I'm over there blubbering, and I couldn't get it out. My thought at that moment was, "Oh my God, they're like me. I did not know you existed. I didn't know there was anybody like me out there. I just thought I was one step ahead of a straitjacket, you know, terrified that we're going to come to get me again or whatever, you know." And so that began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the word journey, and I'll tell you why. It's a French word, journée. It means a day's trip. And that's what we're involved in here. They said to me that morning, "Can you not drink for one day?" And I said, "You know what? Any fool cannot drink for one day." And they said, "Well, that's how we do it. We're just doing this thing one day at a time." God, that's opened up such a tremendous life for me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have this whole day to live. You know, they're going very, very quickly at 82. Trust me when I tell you that, you know. So anyway, marching on here, 25 years later, I ran into somebody accidentally. Like I said, we got so much material to cover, I cannot give you a detailed description of everything here. So you'll have to just bear with me and try to hang on here and try to follow me, okay? So, because a lot went down in between those times, you know, including me and Pat and I. I met a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. We got married. We, in 1979, moved to Tucson, Arizona. We wanted to get out of California, away from the earthquakes and all of that, you know. And moving to Tucson, Arizona was a significant shift in my life. There was a point in there where I was 9 years sober. Everything that could go wrong went wrong in our lives in Arizona. We went broke, and I don't know about you, but if you mess with my money, I get a little bit crazy. And I think I got crazier than I've ever gotten in my entire life in Arizona. I came in one evening, mind you, Pat and I weren't speaking at that point. Like I said, everything that could go wrong in a marriage went wrong, period. Money, everything. So we weren't speaking. We began to sell off everything. We sold off one of our cars. We sold off our furniture. We were living in the one bedroom left, you know. We were sleeping together, but we weren't sleeping together. We were not speaking at all. And I came in one night and I said, or one morning, I said, "Pack our bags, we're leaving." And she said, curiosity, right? She said, "Where would we be going?" And I said, "Well, they're coming to pick us up tonight." And she said, "Who's coming to pick us up tonight?" And I said, "Well, they're coming to pick us up in a flying saucer." And she says to me, "Well, I won't be going with you." Really made me sad, but I had to go. You know, I had to go. So I got my Italian briefcase for you, Federica. Gorgeous briefcase, very expensive, suede and leather. And I got my crystal ball. I got the god Vishnu with the six arms. I packed my slide rule in that briefcase. And off I went to the Catalina Mountains with my Stetson hat on, my Levi's, my Tony Lamas boots, my jacket, my big belt buckle and all that, you know. And because the voices were telling me, come to Mount Lemmon. We will pick you up there, you know. So I drove to Mount Lemmon. I drove to the foot of Mount Lemmon. They said the back road to Mount Lemmon. And I didn't know much about Tucson in those days. Don't you know, I went back there several days later and there's actually a back road to Mount Lemmon. It's all overgrown with that tall yerba grass, you know. But I can see the wagon train marks there from ages ago. And the voices started pulling me up that mountain, and I fell into every piece of cactus on that hill. I got into a wrestling match with a jumping cholla. I ate those prickly pear cactus, you know, trying to get a little moisture because I hadn't taken any water with me. And I began to discard things as I went along, including the briefcase, and the voices were pulling me higher and higher and higher, okay? Until I heard one voice. I heard a voice say, stop. You do not have to do this anymore. Now back down this hill. And that's what I did, back down the hill. And it was about 4:30 in the morning when I was ringing doorbells and the police came. And the policeman says to me, what in the hell do you think you're doing? And I said, well, I need to use someone's phone because I had thrown my briefcase away with my keys in it, you know. And I said, because I need to have my wife come and get me. And he said, well, these people have guns up here. They will kill you, you know. You better get away from here and get away now. And I said, well, I've thrown my keys away. And he said, then I guess you better start walking, you know. So I turned around to walk away. And then I hear him say, oh, hell, get in the car. So I got in the car and he took me home. And he took me right up to my door. And Pat Wood answered the door. And the policeman says to her, he's not drunk. Because I looked like I was. I was battered, beat up, and bloody. And so I started to cry when I looked in her eyes. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, you better get yourself cleaned up. Believe me. I had the worst time in the world getting my clothes off. I was so full of stickers. You know, I had stickers in my skin 2 years after that, and I would pick a sticker out. You know, today sometimes I pull something out and I think, I wonder, you know. So anyway, I finally got my clothes off. I'm standing in the shower, I'm watching the blood go down the drain, and I started to cry again. And I cried like a child. A realization, a huge shift came to me at that moment where I realized I was a drunk down to my big toe. The second thing I realized was that I cannot possibly keep myself sober, that all the king's men, all the king's women tried to get me sober, and not one of them was able to do it. And yet here I was, sober, totally impossibility. And that's really a constant for me today. Now, I've had many awakenings throughout this journey, but that simple little thing was so significant because it's undeniable. I cannot be sober 48 years later. That's not possible, you know? So I know that this is a gift. This is something handed down by the universe, you know? And it's not something to be taken lightly. It has to be, it's a gift, but it has to be nourished and taken care of, you know. So anyway, as time went on here, I should say, tell you this. I got out of the shower and I'm still crying. And I said to Pat again, I don't know what to do. And she said, I think you ought to pray about it. And I looked at her and I said, I don't know how to pray. And she took my hand and we knelt down by the bed and she prayed for me. There's principle before personality, folks. Something happened between her and me at that moment. We've been married 44 years now, totally impossibility for both of us, you know. But something happened between her and me. I had begun, I had my finger on learning how to love another human being, to be considerate of another human being. You know, like I said, I came here so selfish and so self-centered, you know, and you've taught me how to do that. You showed me how to do it through your own example, you know, how the impossibility of us getting together and learning how to love one another and consideration for one another and so on and so forth. So something was born in us that day, and I love her today. She's the love of my life. We don't have a perfect relationship, but we have the ability to communicate and to iron it out or whatever. We don't argue. We don't fight. Neither one of us is going to do that. We do not do that. So we just try to lay it out and try to fix it, you know, however we can. So anyway, I started to tell you earlier that I ran into a guy when I was 20, almost 25 years sober, okay? I bumped into him accidentally. accidentally, at a memorial service for a friend of mine, Chuck Nisbet, who would be deliriously happy that I had mentioned his name this morning. Chuck's gone on, like many, many, many of my friends. That's the thing, if you stay here long enough, you know, a lot of people pass away. But you know what I found out about that? I have him in my heart. Clint Hodges is as close as my next breath. That's the man that I ran into that day. And I bumped into him, actually. I actually bumped into him. And we were at the memorial was dissipating, and they were moving chairs at the Pacific Group, you know, where he was a member. And he said to me, which was characteristic of Clint Hodges, "How can I help you?" And it just fell out of my mouth. I said, "You could be my sponsor." And it's the last thing that I that was on my mind that day. Incidentally, I have a sponsor today. And God love his soul. He's 93 years old. I had coffee with him the other day, and he straightened my head out in a flash. He has an ability to like zero in on whatever it is and make me feel at home and comfortable in my own skin again. That's a great gift, you know, and I love him. I love him to pieces. And he's on the screen this morning, you know, so I wanted to be sure that I mentioned him, because I don't want to go through this life without somebody that this man knows every single thing there is to know about me. You know what? I have no secrets this morning. None. Not one single secret. One person knows all about me. I can't tell you how much freedom that is. It's just totally amazing. So, so Clint gave me his card, and then he was my sponsor for about 3 weeks. And he asked me after about 3 weeks, he said, "Luther, I wonder if you would be interested in going through this process with me." It really, come on, I was 25 years sober. I said, "You know what, I'll have to get back to you on that." And on my way home, I thought, wait a minute. You said if you ask anyone to be your sponsor, you would do whatever they said without question. What is this? Excuse me. So I called him up when I got home. I said, "Clint, I need to meet with you." And he said, "You meet me at Jerry's Deli in the Marina." It's in the Marina del Rey. And you meet me Saturday morning at 10 o'clock and bring your book with you. You know, so I met with him, and we sat down in a booth, and I said, "Clint, I need to ask you right now, why would you ask me to do this? I mean, I have 25 years sober." And he looked straight across from me, and he says, "For two reasons, Luther Wood. Number one, I don't think you're having enough fun. The second reason is there's a loneliness about you that I cannot bear." And he had tears in his eyes. I knew he saw straight through to my soul, because only I knew about the loneliness. I was sponsoring a lot of people, you know. I went to 7 meetings a week, for crying out loud, you know, all the time. And then people in my house doing the steps and doing this, all of that going on, you know. But I knew that he saw straight through to my soul, you know. So we started out on this journey, him and I. And he asked me to open my book there, and he said, "Turn to page 52, or yeah, I think it's 52. And in, on page 52 is the benevolence. And he said, read these over to me and see if any of them apply to you right now. And I said, well, most of them apply to me right now. And he says, well, now don't we know what the problem is? He said, this is a test for alcoholism, for untreated alcoholism, you know? So now we, you know, and it helps to know what the problem is, I'll tell you, you know? Chuck Chamberlain, again, used to tell a story about a Texan. He says, if you're gonna solve a problem, it helps to know what the problem is. For instance, he says, I've always been afraid of dogs. Some little old girl comes walking down the sidewalk with a Great Dane on her leash and says she's not afraid at all. A poodle runs out and I take off. He's over 6 feet tall. It finally became necessary for him to look at the reason that he was afraid of dogs. And he looked and looked and he started to turn the pages of his life back. And he got clear back to when he was 7 years old. He remembered that a little dog bit him. And that was the reason he was afraid of dogs. But he said that didn't completely satisfy him. So the little girl at the time, he looked at it again and he saw that the reason the dog bit him was that he was chasing the little girl at the time. Now, says he, all my life I've been chasing women and getting in trouble and running from dogs, and dogs were never the problem in the first place. So he says it helps to know the problem, okay? And so we know what the problem was, Clint and I, and we started off on this journey together. And he said, you know what? We're going on a journey, you and I, and neither one of us is coming back. And you know what? I committed myself to this program that morning. And when I first started out this program, you know, I wanted to show you something here. Okay, can you see this?
Yes.
All right, this is what my program looked at when I started out with Clint. I was way, way high on unity, way, way high on service. I was going to meetings morning, noon, and night. I was being of service, secretary, this, that, opening doors, setting up chairs, making coffee, washing the cups. You know, in those days we had Chuck cups, doing all the stuff, right? But look at the recovery, the base of it, the very base of my sobriety, you know, was very defective. And it's the only word I can think of, you know. And also, recovery, whether it's Al-Anon or Alcoholics Anonymous, this is the basis for our recovery. And how do we get recovered? Through our, how do we attain recovery, I should say, is through the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps in Al-Anon. This is where emotional sobriety comes from. And this is where sobriety comes from, through these steps. We come here broken up, really torn up from, you know, tore up from the floor up, I hear. So, So it's absolutely essential that we work these steps here. The steps are the gateway to a spiritual experience. You open a portal when you commit yourself to this. You know, we don't get far down the road until we get to step three. But you open a portal here. And I, honest to God, believe if you just will be tenacious, just steadfast and hang in here for the long run, you know, you will receive this gift. It's a promise. It's a promise made to us at the foundation of the universe. We're not dealing with some capricious, penurious, stingy little God. That's not who we're dealing with. If you understood the vastness of, I mean, my God, it blows my mind to even think something this vast. I mean, come on, look at the Milky Way. Look at how huge it is. Do you know that the Earth is a dot in the Milky Way? A dot. And I'm a dot within the dot. You know, something that fabulous that made all of that and everything beyond that, all the universes and everything beyond that. You know, I took a course in astronomy this year. Oh my God. I got straight A's, by the way, in school. I mean, in college, I got my degree in Spanish. I changed my major from French because I'd started out in Loyola University and I changed my major to Spanish and I got 4.0 in every class, including statistics, okay, which is a total impossibility. But astronomy helped me see something, to see this universe that we live in, the perfection of it, you know. And Einstein used to say that underneath the totality of things, there's an energy, force and intelligence that's almost beyond description, you know? And he says, in that sense, I am very religious. That's what Einstein said, my grandpa, you know? So, Einstein was a regular guy too, I want you to know. He's a regular guy here. Can you see him? Albert Einstein, my grandpa. Oh, God. I got him all over the house. I got pictures of him all over my house, all over my little... It's almost like a child's room back there. My wife just shakes her head at me sometimes. Can't you get rid of some of these knickknacks and stuff sometimes? But honest to God, I can't. I gave one to one guy on this screen here because he saw what I saw once. I was given the honor of speaking at a convention in Texas, and an Indian came up to me after speaking, and he pulled this little rock out of his pocket, and he said, "Do you see anything on this?" And I looked at it, and it's a very small little rock, but I saw a tree. I saw trees like a forest, and I saw what I thought was a wolf baying at the moon, right? And he got this big grin on his face, and he says, "I believe this is yours," you know. And I gave it to Todd Moore on the screen here because he said the same thing that I said. You know, I'm into passing along a few treasures here. Am I not, Rick? I passed Rick one of my treasures. Let's see if I can find it here. Hold on a minute. Here we go. Can you see this?
Yes.
This is Rembrandt, one of the most fabulous artists of all time, who was one of us, who died a pauper, by the way.
Oh, didn't know that.
Yeah. He loved The Prodigal Son. He loved that story. He painted him all kinds of paintings in a bordello with the girl on his lap, a hat with a long feather in it, you know, glass of wine, so on and so forth. This was the last one. This is your story if you're alcoholic. This is my story. Or this is if you're a human being and you think you've done too much and crossed too many lines, okay? This is how the Father treats you and me. You see, the boy has come home with his head shorn because he had lice and all of that. He's Jewish. He's been working in a pig farm and fain would eat the husks that they had for the pigs. And all of a sudden realize, wait a minute, the servants in my Father's house are eating better than I am. And he went home to his father, who didn't beat up on him, by the way. And he came in his underwear. Look at it. It's all ripped and torn and dirty, and his shoes are worn down to nothing, you know? What did the father do? He pulled him to his breast, and he hugged him. And he said, "Kill the fatted calf. We're going to have a party." The boy was dead, and now he lives. You can see his brother wasn't real happy there about it. you know, and that may happen to you along the way where people are not real happy about it, you know, but accept this gift from our Father and be welcome in his house, which is where we are today, you know. So anyway, I'm sorry about all the blubbering, but I can't help it. You know, you've opened up my heart and I can't help it. So,
it's 10 and, o'clock.
Huh?
It's 10 o'clock.
You know what? We'll go on with this, but I think some of you might like a little bit of a break here for crying out loud to go to the restroom or have a cigarette or whatever. Let's come back at 10:15, okay? And try not to be late because, like, I'm trying to pour a lot of information in here before we quit. So I've loved being with you for these moments. And I'll see you back at 10:15, okay?
Thank you, Luther.